It's the takeaway from Monday, July 8th. Generational divides are emerging between Democratic leaders.
A lot of the Democrats I've spoken to kind of have PTSD because they're very worried that if they go for a female candidate or if they go for a candidate of color, that that person may not be able to beat Trump.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, we'll try to make sense of where the party is heading with 2020 on the horizon. Also on the show, a look at billionaire Jeffrey Epstein's recent arrest on charges of sex trafficking dozens of underage girls, and the plea deal that helped him avoid serious punishment a decade ago. And facial recognition may be coming to an airport near you, raising major red flags for digital privacy advocates. Plus, we hear from you about what you're reading this summer to get your mind off the heat.
I'm reading These Truths, The History of the United States by Jill Lepore.
Parable of the Sower by Octavia Butler.
The Power Broker by Robert Caro.
Less by Andrew Sean Greer.
But first, let's talk Democrats. As we get closer to the next presidential election, the Democratic Party has been moving further to the left in some notable ways.
I strongly believe that we need to have Medicare for all.
The Green New Deal itself is a resolution to be more expansive.
If you were to put $1,000 a month in their hands, they use it in the most positive and beneficial way possible.
But on some issues, the Democratic Party has also expressed deepening divisions between establishment Democrats like former Vice President Joe Biden.
I believe Democrats want to unify this nation. That's what our party's always been about.
And more progressive candidates like Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren.
There's a lot to be learned from countries in Scandinavia and Western Europe.
They want to hear about how you really are going to break up those tech giants and big ag and the big banks.
And that tension within the party is also playing out in Congress. At the end of June, the House and the Senate passed a bill that directed $4.5 billion worth of funding to the border. But 95 House Democrats voted against the bill. They were concerned that it gave the Trump administration too much discretion over how to spend the funds. Over the weekend, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi gave an interview to the New York Times where she was asked about some of the progressive Democrats who opposed the border bill, including Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Rashida Tlaib. Pelosi said, quote, "All these people have their public whatever and their Twitter world, but they didn't have any following." Here's how Tlaib responded to Pelosi's comments on Sunday on ABC's This Week.
Uplift the women, especially the women of color within your caucus that are out there, because I'll tell you, more people like us, more people like me that come out to vote, we win. All of us win.
Different visions emerging from different generations of the Democratic Party creating rifts within the party at a critical moment for the left. Joining me now to discuss Democratic messaging heading into 2020 is Laura Barrón López, national reporter for Politico. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Joan Walsh, national affairs correspondent for The Nation. Thanks for being with us, Joan.
Glad to be with you.
So, Laura, let's start with you. I mean, off of the New York Times piece about Nancy Pelosi, this isn't the first time that Pelosi's been, I guess you could say, dismissive towards Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and some of the other young progressive women of color in the party. Why do you think she's willing to go after Democrats like AOC so publicly?
Right. So initially, Ocasio-Cortez, as well as Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, took issue with Pelosi. So they kind of launched some attacks themselves first because they were very upset with this border aid bill, which sent money down to the border to hopefully relieve some of the crisis that's going on there with children and migrants and at detention facilities. And so they were upset that this bill didn't include any kind of standards for hygiene and nutrition for these child migrants. And they lobbed some attacks at Pelosi, got very upset with leadership. And so Pelosi responded. And part of the reason she does this is also because she's trying to protect the moderate wing of her party, the vulnerable Democrats who put the party in the House majority. And so this is her bit of strategic maneuvering to try to shield them in the larger messaging battle.
I want to talk a little bit more about who those moderate Dems are and how vulnerable they actually are. But Joan, I want to get your take on Speaker Pelosi's comments to the New York Times over the weekend. Who is she trying to appeal to here? And how did you interpret those comments?
Well, on one level, I feel like everybody is playing an assigned role. You know, she has to stand up for the moderates, or she feels she has to. We can discuss whether she does have to or not. But they are a larger part of her caucus. And, you know, she has been taking incoming from some of these newly elected progressive leaders. But I've been watching this, you know, since the session began. And initially, my reporting was, and I did a profile of Pramila Jayapal, who is the chair of the House Progressive Caucus, and she has played a real in-between role, you know, working with Pelosi, but also working with her progressive, new progressive leaders who she wants to mentor. And, you know, for a while, I felt like they all had it kind of under control. They were not going to be played against each other. There was a constant effort in the beginning of the session. If you remember, Rashida Tlaib said a word I can't repeat on the air about we're going to
impeach this.
Somebody, mm-hmm. This something. And Pelosi dodged a couple of attempts to get her to challenge Tlaib and say, you know, chasten her, censure her. She said, I won't do that. But now I think the result of this funding, border funding bill, has genuinely left bad feelings on both sides. They're really, you know, as Laura says, what these women, what these progressives were asking for is really very small when you break it down to, you know, nutrition and hygiene. But Pelosi felt like she got the best deal she could. And how could anybody stand in the way of getting at least some funding to alleviate this crisis? And this is a battle I think that's going to be played out many times, you know, in the next year.
Laura, you've been covering this for a while. Do we know how Democrat voters felt about the lack of unity in dealing with the border bill? And I want to talk a little bit about this outside of the Twitter sphere, which I feel like if you're a media person or you're a Politico, then that's where you're sort of, you know, in this bubble. But outside of that, what are Democratic voters feeling about the border bill and whether or not they supported the version that actually ended up passing?
So, as you mentioned, Tanzina, if you look at the Twitter world, yes, it looks as though everyone is up in arms. Progressives are furious. You know, this is do or die. But honestly, when you look at polling, a number of Democratic voters, you know, want to see aggressive action by Congress, but they also want to see immediate relief. And that's something that Senate Democrats wanted to respond to. And that is why this wasn't just, you know, Republicans or Trump forcing Pelosi to accept this bill. Senate Democrats were very much on board with what ultimately passed, and they pretty much told House Democrats, look, we want to go with this. We're not going to make really any tweaks, and let's just get this done and send some money down there. And I think that the overwhelming majority of voters are okay with that. And also that they're distracted by other issues, not just this, but healthcare and wages. And so when I've been on the trail, that's what I hear about the most, not so much the crisis on the border.
And Laura, I'm wondering, is this a case of incumbents like Pelosi just not being progressive enough? Or are there other factors at play in this sort of divide, at least is how we're seeing it?
I think it's very difficult to label Pelosi as not progressive, given her record as a politician. She, for a long time, has been one of the most progressive in the chamber. But yes, we are seeing this new class of progressive Democrats that have come in the 2018 wave, and they are different politicians to a degree. Ocasio-Cortez acts much more as an activist in her position. We've seen that in the way that she challenges her colleagues, her Democratic colleagues on Twitter. And there's a bit of restlessness among the base and very diehard Democrats. And so I think that 2020 will be illustrative in how far that movement is able to go. Because in 2018, honestly, even though there were a lot of primary challengers to sitting Democrats and sitting Republicans, only four out of a large number defeated sitting incumbents, and two of those were Democrats. And so one of those was Ocasio-Cortez. So it's very difficult to tell whether or not this will increase in 2020. and whether or not there actually is a lot of wind at their backs.
We can't end this segment without talking about Joe Biden, who up until very recently has been considered the moderate, the centrist, you know, must-win campaign. And frankly, that's been challenged after the first Democratic debate. Over the weekend, Biden apologized for comments he made about working with segregationist senators to get things done in Congress. What do some of his recent statements about race reveal to us about the different generations of the Democratic Party as we approach 2020, and also more broadly, this sort of centrist white male candidate versus, you know, candidates like Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris or even, you know, Julian Castro?
You know, I think Vice President Biden did not do himself any favors by coming out rather belligerent last week and insisting, you know, basically that thing that a lot of us white folks do, which is, you know, my heart, I don't have a racist bone, wherever the racist bone is. I haven't found it. But, you know, a really defensive, I was Barack's vice president. You know me, I couldn't be guilty of these things that you're accusing me of. When in fact, he was guilty of some of what he was being accused of, he really took the lead. He did not simply vote with the segregationists on busing measures. He led them. You know, if he was going to apologize, he should have just apologized. Kamala Harris's attack would never have happened. He had a back and forth with Cory Booker, which was like a manhood test. You know, no, I'm not going to apologize. You apologize. Cory should apologize. And then he apologizes. And that, I think, is going to be a big problem for Vice President Biden.
Laura, is the Democratic Party ready to move away from the centrist white male candidate, a.k.a. Joe Biden and company?
Well, that's the big debate raging right now in this primary. And part of the issue that I think drawn so many Democrats to Biden is what happened in 2016. A lot of the Democrats I've spoken to kind of have PTSD because they're very worried that if they go for a female candidate or if they go for a candidate of color, that person may not be able to beat Trump. And then the pushback to that is, well, electability is a bit of a code word for let's just not elect a minority or someone that looks different. Polling, even though, yes, it is a snapshot in time, seems to suggest that Democrats are starting to think that Biden may not be the best option for them. And the debate did a lot of that. Also, Elizabeth Warren, who has run this steady race of issuing very detailed policy proposals from the very beginning and making strategic plays for Black voters and for Latino voters, and she and Kamala Harris have been able to rise in the polls because of that. And also in head-to-head matchups with Trump, they appear to be beating him. So that's helping their case as well. Again, it's months away from the first primary, so we have to see whether or not Democratic voters in Iowa and New Hampshire actually break with someone like Biden because he's leading in those states right now.
And miles to go. Laura Barrón López is a national reporter for Politico, and Joan Walsh is a national affairs correspondent for The Nation. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Billionaire hedge fund manager Jeffrey Epstein was arrested this weekend on charges of sex trafficking dozens of underage girls in New York and Florida. Here's U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Jeffrey Berman, speaking about the charges against Epstein at a press conference on Monday.
The alleged behavior shocks the conscience. And while the charged conduct is from a number of years ago, it is still profoundly important to the many alleged victims, now young women. They deserve their day in court, and we are proud to be standing up for them by bringing this indictment.
This is not the first time Epstein has faced accusations of abuse and pedophilia, which have followed him for well over a decade. But it could end up being the first time he sees severe punishment for them. About 12 years ago, Epstein pleaded guilty to state charges of soliciting prostitution in Florida, but a plea deal made with the state prosecutors, including Alexander Acosta, then U.S. attorney in Miami and the current U.S. Secretary of Labor in the Trump administration, ensured an extremely lenient sentence. Now these latest charges from the Southern District of New York are raising new questions about how much Epstein's powerful allies knew about his behavior and what they did to protect him. Devlin Barrett of The Washington Post has been following all of this, and he joins us now. Devlin, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tanzina. Thanks for having me.
So we said that Jeffrey Epstein has been accused of this before. What is he being charged with now? What new information does the SDNY have that prompted these charges?
What we understand the charges to be are essentially sex trafficking of children, very similar conduct to that which led to his past plea deal.
Now, Devlin, what do we know about Epstein's victims in general? Is there a profile of who they are beyond just being young?
Being young, being high school and sometimes middle school girls who were recruited to come to his homes and give him massages. And then, according to the accusations, he would essentially see how far he could go with some of them. I don't want to get into graphic detail, obviously, but they were brought to his home on the pretense of giving massages. And it often became something much worse. And often they were the girls who were targeted, many of them now women, say they were targeted because, you know, they were kids with problems. They were kids who, you know, needed money. They were in some ways more vulnerable teenagers than most.
Now, when we say these girls were brought to him, who was bringing these young girls to Epstein?
He had assistants, and there were women who knew his assistants who would essentially facilitate the bringing of girls to his homes.
We also know there's been a lot of speculation about some of the very powerful acquaintances that Epstein has. I want to talk about a couple of those. First of all, President Trump. What do we know about President Trump's relationship with Epstein?
Sure. Well, Epstein, you know, he's a very wealthy man. He is spent years hanging out with socialites and powerful people. And so he's been photographed with the president and, you know, he's spent time socially with a lot of the rich and powerful people in America and some rich and powerful people in England. And that is definitely part of the reason why there is a fascination about his case.
Now, we also have heard Bill Clinton, for example, has also had a relationship with Epstein. Do we know anything about the depth of that relationship?
Well, again, this is essentially about rich and famous people hanging out with each other. I think sometimes what happens in the reporting on Epstein is people assume that because Epstein knows these people and is friends with these people, they must have been involved in some way with the criminal activity. I mean, I think there's not a lot of evidence to support that at this point. But obviously, it's something to be concerned about when a rich and powerful person ends up getting what many, many people involved in the case viewed as a sweetheart plea deal. And is there a reason that that person got a very soft deal that would be connected to his connections?
Well, let's talk a little bit about that deal, because that did involve Alex Acosta, who's the current labor secretary. This was about 12 years ago when he was then in Miami. What kind of deal did he give Epstein? And has he ever or will he ever be held accountable for that sweetheart deal?
One of the, I think, alarming pieces of this, from the point of view of someone who's covered a lot of law enforcement cases over the years, is that the people who struck this deal with Epstein, by and large, don't want to defend it publicly. And I think that's very suggestive of how generous the terms were to Epstein. And the deal was that he was facing at the time a possible 53-page indictment for these crimes. And instead, a federal indictment, instead they arranged for him to make a plea deal in state court to two charges and essentially a sentence of a little more than a year in jail. But even that was softened to the point where he was allowed to leave jail to work in an office space up to 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. That is not the kind of deal that the vast, vast majority of sex offenders get in this country. And especially given how serious the federal case looked at one point, to water it down, frankly, to such a gentle and light state case really raised a lot of eyebrows then and now.
I'm wondering about the victims. We know the victims in this prior case that we talked about were sort of kept in the dark about the deal that was struck between Acosta and Epstein. Depending on how this case with the Southern District of New York goes, could the victim see any type of justice? And if so, what kind?
I think one of the basic bedrock principles of prosecutions and law enforcement, both on the federal and state level, a big reason why you do these prosecutions is to get justice for the victims. And one of the ways in which the Epstein plea deal originally was frankly out of whack and weird to people who'd done this work for a long time is that the victims themselves were kept in the dark and basically only told after the fact. Now, that does happen from time to time with crime victims. It's not a perfect system by any means. But I think in this case, there's been a lot of concern that it's one of the most egregious examples of keeping victims in the dark, of not giving them at least a chance to say to a prosecutor, here's what I want out of all this. If I'm going to have to, you know, talk about what happened to me, I would like to see justice done this way or that way. You know, the victims here didn't even get that chance. And I think for a lot of them, and a lot of the reason why they are coming forward now is for women to say what happened was so wrong, is because they didn't get that chance. And the justice system is designed to give them that chance. And it's always been one of the more disturbing features of this case that they were shut out that way.
Devlin Barrett is a reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks to you, Devlin.
Thank you.
If you were in an airport over the 4th of July holiday, there's a chance you saw some new technology as you were checking in. Facial recognition scans. It might not seem like a big deal at first. I mean, some consumers are even unlocking their phones with facial scans. But privacy researchers are wary, saying that this technology is not necessarily secure. And it's just one more piece of private data individuals are giving away to both big companies and the government. Allie Funk is tracking all of this. She's a research analyst for Freedom House. Allie, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, nice to be here.
So, but I want to get into how this actually works, but is it just people checking in? Is it checking out? Because I ran into this checking out of Newark Airport a while ago. What is going on?
It's a great question, and I think we're all kind of trying to figure that out as well, because the programs aren't as transparent as we would hope as, you know, regular ordinary travelers, but also as a human rights researcher. So TSA, the Travel Security Administration, is actually using it in different ways. So you can use it if you have TSA PreCheck. They may be collecting some biometric data from you. But CBP, Customs and Border Protection, they're actually using facial recognition when you board the plane, particularly for international travel right now. And they're partnering with different airline companies. So Delta has a program with them, JetBlue, American Airlines. So they're actually using facial recognition during the boarding process. So instead of handing over your passport, they can take a facial scan, and then it matches to a database that they have that is populated by different visa applications, images from your passport, visa applications. So it's being used at the boarding process. It's being used throughout the airport. We're trying to figure out a little bit more detail. But, you know, right now it's supposed, all these systems are supposed to be opt out. So you have the right not to do it. But
that's not what happened to me at Newark Airport, though, Allie. I was very confused. Said, wait, why am I doing this? Why are you? And this was leaving after an international flight.
Yeah.
And not only were people in line behind me very upset, but the people who were doing the scan were also very upset. They had no idea whether I could opt out and just said, you got to do it. And so I had to do it.
Yeah. So that is the problem, right? You know, I just went through this experience. I was in Detroit and I was boarding an international flight, and Delta over the intercom was like, we're using facial scans, no need for your passport. And I was waiting for the, hey, you can opt out if you don't feel comfortable and this is how you do it. It never came. So it seems like we had a similar experience. But yeah, so CBP and TSA have affirmed that this is an opt-out system. But as we know, they're not communicating that it is, and they're not telling travelers how to do that, which is really worrisome. So that's why we're trying to do a lot of advocacy around you can opt out. This is how you do it. And this is probably why you should do it as well.
So why should you do it? Because how is our data, like what happens when my face gets scanned by Delta or American or whoever?
Yeah. So what's happening, you know, on the technical side is it's creating a facial scan, which is kind of just a map of your face. It's creating indicators like, hey, how far are your eyes apart? Where's your chin, your cheekbones? That facial scan is created by an algorithm that can then be matched to your identity. So it goes off to, it compares in another imaging, so that matches your face to your passport and then confirms your identity. So, you know, it may sound, oh, that's great, that's quick, that's convenient, but there's some really serious privacy concerns and also some really technical issues. So just starting, you know, with starters for the technical concerns is facial recognition, it's not reliable and it's not accurate. So there's been a lot of research done on this. One report that I was reading said that for white men, it's 99% accurate. But for women who have darker skin, there's a 35% error rate. So that's pretty big. And then on top of that, there are all these privacy and civil rights concerns because the data is not being cured. We don't know how it's being stored, if that's secure, and it's probably not because there's already been data breaches. And then also, there are just larger civil rights concerns of how is the government and how are private companies using this data? Are private companies as Delta, American Airlines, are they going to be using it for commercial concerns? And is the government using it, maybe giving it to law enforcement to maybe, you know, even look at peaceful protests?
Why are so many people so willing to sort of do this? I mean, is it because they think it's convenient? They're not aware of the civil rights concerns? Because like I said, I was the lone person on that line that was causing quite a concern about my face being scanned and nobody was on board.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think there's a couple of things happening here, particularly airports. Travel's really stressful, especially international travel. People are sick of the long lines. They want to board. They want to get comfortable in their seats, or they want to get through customs quickly. So, you know, people, the airlines are saying, this is for convenience. This is for you as a customer. So I think that's an incentive to do it. I think also, you know, ICE and CBP have really pushed the line of this is for security. So people may say, okay, whatever keeps me safe. And also, I think there's just a lack of understanding about actually what are the concerns of this technology and the implication of its being used, not just in the airport, but in everyday life.
So we've seen an example that really quickly on Sunday, the Washington Post reported that the FBI and ICE were using scanning state driver's license databases for facial recognition technology. Is that one of those examples you're talking about? I always call it like when they start to connect the pipes, you know, about facial recognition scans one place and something else. That's where I get concerned about data. Mm-hmm. So is that what you mean when everyday world sort of comes together with our facial recognition scans?
Exactly. So, you know, we may be, if you're a traveler, you're consenting to this use within that specific environment, but we have no idea if CBP is sharing that information. And I think the reporting out of the Washington Post yesterday really underscores that. So, you know, when we got our driver's license, we gave our image. I never said, here, I want to drive and need my driver's license. Feel free to use this image to the FBI or ICE for whatever purpose. So you Americans aren't consenting to the ways in which their data is being used. And I think it's even more troubling with your face because you can't get a new face. You can get a new email address if your identity is stolen, but your face is your face and you can't hide it.
So Allie, really quickly, we've got just under a minute left. If I want to opt out, how can I do that?
I think the first thing for the travelers to be aware, which means you have to pay attention where it's being used, because sometimes it may not be used as obvious. So at the boarding process, if you see it, just say, hey, I want to opt out. Here's my passport. It should be as easy as that. If you're going through customs line, you should ask an airport representative how to opt out, because we've been assured that right now that's the way to do it. And we need public pressure to try to resist this new technology.
Allie Funk is a research analyst for Freedom House. Thank you so much, Allie.
Thank you so much.
There's plenty of summer left, which means you still have time to crack open a book on the beach or in the comfort of your hopefully cool home. And we asked what you're reading to beat the heat.
My name is Capone Ascension, and I'm calling from St. Paul, Minnesota. And my book recommendations for this summer are Beloved by Toni Morrison, Parable of the Sower by Octavia Butler, Parable of the Talents by Octavia Butler, and Kindred by Octavia Butler.
This is Patricia in Melbourne, and I am reading Becoming, the Michelle Obama book, and it is an amazing read. It's very honest, funny, her life from birth in Chicago right through to her husband's presidency. Just very interesting, regardless of your politics.
Hi, this is Diane in San Diego. I'm reading These Truths, A History of the United States by Jill Lepore. It's a deep and gripping read, and I'm recommending it to everybody I know.
Hi, this is Lydia from Harlem, and I'm reading The Power Broker by Robert Caro. It's the biography of Robert Moses, and it's great to read how Moses transformed the New York City infrastructure and then go for a drive or walk on the city that he shaped.
Lots of interesting picks there. Thanks so much for sharing them with us. And for those of you who are still deciding what to read this summer, our next guest has some suggestions that might help you narrow down your reading list. Parul Sehgal is a book critic for the New York Times. Thanks for being with us, Parul.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get into your recommendations, what do you look for in a good summer read?
I mean, I think I look for what I look for in any book, which is be immersive, be intelligent, and monopolize me.
Just take me over.
Just be ruthless.
I'm with that. I'm totally with that. If you don't get it, do you have a limit on pages? Like, if you don't get me in the first 10, 15, 20?
Oh, I'm the worst. If you can't get me in the first 5, 6 pages, I mean, I have to read contractually. I'm bound to some of these books. So am I sometimes. But generally, yeah, win me over right away.
I'm with that. Yeah. That totally works. So let's get into your picks. We have the first book, which is Mostly Dead Things by Kristen Arnett. And it's a comic novel. And this is the story of a queer taxidermist set in Florida.
What's not to love?
I mean, already.
Are you in?
Intrigued. Very intrigued.
So some of my other recommendations are a little bit serious and sober, but this book is... in my review, I called it a cabinet of wonders, and it really is. It's a comic novel. It's a little bit sad. It's a little bit sexy. It's a little strange, and it feels like an American original. So as you said, it's about this queer woman who's very inconveniently in love with her brother's wife, and her father's just committed suicide, and she's just like all the best heroes or heroines, lovelorn, a little unlucky. And the book, like in great comic novel fashion, is just sort of one set piece after another, but then kind of opens up to really ask some more interesting, deeper questions about memory and about forgetting. And it's fantastically set in Central Florida, which has a great tradition of cultural amnesia, as the author writes. It's everything's being made into a strip mall. There's been the erasure of the Seminole Indians. And so it is something that's funny and effortless and light, but also really does dilate to ask some interesting nagging questions.
Your second pick is Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments by Saida Hartman. It's a cultural history book, and Hartman's a historian, but she's been centering the stories of some figures who have typically been marginalized in U.S. history. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is history as I've never read it. What Hartman does is she focuses on a revolution in private life, in intimate life at the cusp of the 20th century. So first of all, how do you write a history like this? How do you write a history of how people are actually... ordinary people are rethinking marriage, motherhood, sexuality. And she says that the people who really, sort of spearheaded this change were young black women, 2 or 3 generations out of slavery, come up to the cities of the North in the Great Migration and toss out the old scripts. And so she writes this history, finding these women, some of them in the ledgers of the institutions that were designed to discipline and punish them. So some of them are obviously mental institutions, prisons, but then also anonymous photographs and stories. So as you're reading this book, you're both getting a picture of ordinary women, but also suddenly you'll be like, wait a second, is this Billie Holiday? Mm. Is this Ida B. Wells? So she has a way of marrying the histories, official history, and ordinary life in a way that feels, for me, absolutely breathtakingly original. And then she does this other thing, which she says, okay, there are these gaps in these lives, so how do I conjure them? She uses fiction. She imagines things. Now, this is something that's going to be interesting. Some people are going to like it. Some people are going to think this is too unorthodox. So it's another book that sort of generates lots of productive questions.
I can already feel my brain buzzing here.
Oh, it's so lushly illustrated. It's just beautiful.
No Visible Bruises is your third pick, and that is by Rachel Louise Snyder. It's a current affairs book, and this book is about domestic violence, which, as you said, you've got some heavy topics here. Yeah. What stood out to you about this particular work?
Well, this book is, I'm comparing it to Silent Spring. It's a page-turner. It's a book about something that is, the United Nations, I think last year, said that the home is the most dangerous place for a woman worldwide. And who is called domestic violence a global health problem of epidemic proportions. So you're saying, do I really need to read a book that's going to convince me of this? But you must read this book, because what this book does is it sort of chips away at things that we think we know about this problem. Why women don't leave, why men become abusers, why these men can't change. And slowly what Snyder does, she's an investigative journalist, is she corrects the score. She finds the news stories by following a bunch of different women, following different agencies. And then, like Rachel Carson did in A Silent Spring, this is not a book that's interested in despair. This is a book that's interested in action. It's interested in change. And she does this, one, by writing a book that's a literary achievement. And then secondly, by saying that there are things that are working all over the world. There are things that we should all be doing. So it's not a book that permits despair, which I find extremely galvanizing.
Particularly with that topic.
With this topic. Mm.
Now, your fourth pick is Lost Children Archive by Valeria Luiselli. And this is fiction, and it's about child migrants at the border, which is something that's very real that we've talked about a lot on this show. How well does it capture the reality of the situation?
Very well. Luiselli served for a while as an interpreter for refugee children who are applying for the green card. So she knows this topic intimately. She's written one nonfiction book about it, which came out, I think, in 2016. And now she's fictionalized it. And she's fictionalized it in a way that I see more and more Western writers trying to sort of get their heads around the refugee crisis. But she is perhaps the most original young writer of her generation. And so, of course, she does something that is absolutely unclassifiable. So she wants to write about the crisis at the border, and she wants to write about the refugee children. But it's not in a way that she wants to necessarily embody their lives. It's the story of a marriage. It's the story of a woman, an archivist, wants to go, much like Luiselli did, and understand this issue. So it's a classic American road novel, but on top of it is layered the stories that are happening. And because she does both, you get a real sense of how these stories that are happening on the border, these stories of these children, are not separate from our intimate lives. They're not separate from American history. And so she braids them together in a way that feels really fiercely original and intelligent.
We've got 1 minute left, or less than a minute left. I want to get in your fifth book, which is The Old Drift by Namwarly Sirpel, a historical novel. Tell us about this.
Okay, this is for anybody who wants that big immersive novel to suck up your summer. It's about almost 600 pages, shades of Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Salman Rushdie. It's a multi-generational epic, a matrilineal epic, and it tells the story of what's now known as Zambia from colonialism to years ahead in the future. And it's funny and, you know, just lavishly intelligent. So.
Harel Segal is a book critic at the New York Times. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, back in the chair, and this is The Takeaway.